This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. So far, the 2008 presidential election has focused more on money than substance and more on politics than policy, but that began to change last Thursday. The eight declared Democratic presidential candidates squared off in South Carolina on issues, Iraq and Iran, abortion and health care. Tomorrow night, the Republican candidates staged their first debate at the Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. Early debates offer unique opportunities and risks. Issue candidates get a platform, dark horses get a chance to introduce themselves, and the front runners, well, they do their best not to mess up too badly. In just a moment, Democrat Anna Greenberg and Republican Ed Rogers join us for the latest in our occasional series, So You Want to Be President. A little later on, we'll get an analysis from political junkie Ken Rudin about last week's Democratic debate and look ahead to tomorrow's Republican debate, plus the politics of the Iraq War funding bill veto, the opening of a congressional investigation into a disputed election in, where else, Florida. If you have questions for the political junkie, you can email us now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, do you pay attention to debates 9 months before the primaries begin? Why or why not? What are you looking for? 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now are our campaign veterans, Republican strategist Ed Rogers and Democratic consultant Anna Greenberg. He worked on the Bush-Quayle campaign in 1988. Ms. Greenberg worked on Bill Clinton's campaign in 1992 and Al Gore's in 2000. They're both with us here in Studio 3A. Great to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Ed Rogers, how does a candidate win a primary debate?
Well, the multi-candidate appearances are probably a better term than debate. But it's pretty simple. The front runners want to still be front runners after the debate, and the people in the back of the pack want to think that, and they want others to think that they have broken through somehow. Mm-hmm. So for the front runners, it's about not making a mistake. For the backbenchers or the second tier of candidates, it's about breaking through, having a zinger, getting the biggest applause line, and supplying the media hook for the next day's coverage.
Given that the audiences for these debates are so relatively small, isn't that media coverage what the TV networks and the newspapers and I guess the blogs at this time say about it? Anna, isn't that the most important thing?
Yes, it is. It's absolutely the case, particularly with primary debates, not as much with general debates, that most people are going to learn about it and experience it through the lens of the coverage. And so whether that's how individual candidates are evaluated, their performance by the by media outlets and the discussions on the blogs, or the clips they see on TV, the selected clips that are seen on TV. And so there's a huge amount of effort actually put into the spin. There's a spin room after the debate. You probably saw it on MSNBC, everyone wandering around trying to, you know, say their piece with the different journalists that were covering it. There's a huge amount of effort put into trying to make sure that your campaign gets the best spin possible after the debate.
How do you arrange spin, Ed?
First of all, something does need to have happened. And in the post-debate coverage, there's a rule. Good gets better, bad gets worse. And so the good things become metaphors for the strong candidate and for the candidate that's perceived to have won. The bad become metaphors on why a campaign or a candidate is struggling or out of touch. So, but it starts right afterwards, but you can't argue common sense. you can't argue against common sense. You've got to sort of push them the way they're leaning. So, like I said, good will get better, bad will get worse.
Ed's exactly right. I mean, the example from the debate last week was Joe Biden's answer to Brian Williams, where he just said, yes.
Yeah, are you going to be a gas bag as president?
Right. Was and not put your foot in your mouth, yes. And then, not yes, he would be a gas bag, but yes, he would control himself. And that became the lens by which the example that everybody used on how well Joe Biden had done in that debate. Mm-hmm. Not really the substance of his answers on other questions, but that actual response.
Now, when you're figuring this out ahead of time, these are prepared lines, you would think.
Very often, yeah. I mean, very often you go in with a set of memorized lines. You go in with a set of note cards that are in some cases color-coded, in some cases in bold print, and they're arranged in such a way so when an issue comes up, you can instantly flip to your card for reference. And if it's not clumsy and it's not contrived, you want to insert your predetermined, your pre-written line, mm-hmm. talking point, sound bite, whatever it is.
I guess the famous example of that is Ronald Reagan's line about asked about his age in the debate with Walter Mondale, and he said, I refuse to make my opponent's youth and inexperience an issue in this campaign.
Sure, here again, a rehearsed line, premeditated. Reagan, the debate served him very well over the course of his career. He arguably finished George Bush in the 1980 primaries with the famous line that I paid for this microphone mm-hmm. in one of the multi-candidate debates in New Hampshire mm-hmm. in 1980.
Anna, that spin area outside, this is after the, even sometimes during it, but outside, it's where the reporters all are. Do you send the candidate out there? Do you send a surrogate for the candidate? How big a deal do you make about that?
Well, historically, it has mainly been the campaigns, the campaign manager or the pollster or the other elected officials that are allied with the campaign. They go and make the case for their candidate. What we saw in this particular one, we had most of the candidates except Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama actually stayed around and did very long post-debate interviews. I think, Dennis Kucinich and Richardson were interviewed for 15, 20 minutes after the debate. That's a bit unusual. What I take from that is that it's getting harder and harder. I mean, journalists are sophisticated. It's not easy to spin journalists. And so my take is that it's getting harder and harder for campaigns to break through. So by actually having the candidates available, not mm-hmm. just the staff or the allies, is their attempt to try and have an opportunity for, outside of the context of eight people being on the stage, a direct, direct contact.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255 is our number. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Octavio. Octavio is with us from Miami, Florida.
Yes, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I just wanted to say that I do listen to debates and watch the media appearances this early on. And as a reflective and discerning voter, I want to see and hear as much as I can and try to make the best decision that I can when the time comes to vote.
Mm-hmm. And what in particular are you looking for? Stances on issues?
Most of those I think that I already know. I'm looking for leadership style. I'm looking for the ability of the candidate to handle himself in a controversial and challenging situation.
To see if they're quick, sure on their feet, comfortable in their own skins, I guess is the famous line.
That's right, and ready to do that when as a leader of the country and a leader of his people or her people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do think these events are important, and they're becoming more important, not less so. I think people increasingly make their own decisions based on what they see of the candidates on live TV, be it on the debates mm-hmm. or on one of the Sunday shows or some other cable outlet, that how a candidate performs on live TV matters more than ever.
I was just going to say that I think that it's very hard in these contexts to have deep ideological divisions among the candidates. So you have a difference of opinion between Hillary Clinton and John Edwards and Chris Dodd about their vote in the Senate, but they all basically are critical of the war in Iraq and basically all want to have some various withdrawal plan. So you're not going to watch these debates to find these massive ideological arguments. It's going to be about the leadership style, the gravitas, the intelligence, how they handle themselves. Mm. Are they a human being?
Mm. Octavio, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And I was just going to ask you, Ed Rogers, about that. In these multiple candidate appearances, as you call them, or early primary debates, don't you have to be careful about attacking other members of your own party?
You certainly do. And this isn't the forum that lends itself to that this early in the campaign, particularly if you're not a very well-known candidate, because you tend to define yourself by the negative that you use on another. And in the Republican primaries, in the Republican process, we have a term for it, the Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment. And, mm-hmm. and obviously tomorrow night being at the Reagan Library, a big component of everyone's remarks will be in tribute to Reagan. And so violate the...
And how the mantle of the Reagan legacy falls squarely on their own shoulders.
The 11th commandment, exactly.
Yeah.
Starting with the 11th commandment.
But if you're an issue candidate and you have, one issue that you really want to stress, Tom Tancredo perhaps on the Republican side, or Dennis Kucinich perhaps on the Democratic side, you just want to hit that issue again and again and again, right?
Well, you do. Whether or not it's wise to do so is a different story, but yeah. We've got some extremists, they've got some extremists, and they'll be on the stage for the next few months.
Mm-hmm. See if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to, this is Scott with us from Princeton in New Jersey.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say this debate pointed out what past debates show, and that's the difficulty that sitting senators have in defending their record. Governor Richardson did a wonderful job of explaining that he was a governor, and his points were very clear. All the senators are going to be shown as flip-floppers, and I think the Democrats need to wake up and actually nominate somebody who can defeat a Mayor Giuliani or Governor Romney.
Mm-hmm. I assume the same applies to members of Congress, longtime members of Congress, all of whom have confusing votes to explain, Anna.
Well, I think the longer you've been in the Senate or in the House, obviously you've got a series of votes that don't always hold together. The flip side is you have experience. I mean, you have, in this particular field, you have a number, most of the candidates are incredibly qualified, have incredible experience, have successes that they can point to. Chris Dodd has, you know, the family medical leave. I mean, I think that the breadth of experience you bring and the gravitas it gives this field is actually quite beneficial to these candidates.
And we haven't elected a sitting senator in over 40 years. I hope Richardson wins the nomination.
All right, Scott. Thanks very much for the call. And this on the Republican side, I guess Governor Romney would bring some advantages too, and Mayor Giuliani.
Well, having a long, distinguished career in Congress, be Republican or Democrat, is probably a net plus. But sure, it does give you the political equivalent of a paper trail for people to pick at and to work on. And by definition, when you're a governor, you're not part of the problem that's Washington, that every few years people want to rebel and revolt against. So, but having said that, politicians tend to make the best politicians, and I think having a distinguished career in Congress is probably a net plus rather than a net minus.
With the presidential debates underway again, we're talking about strategy stakes and, of course, the spin, and we'll take your calls 9 months before the first primaries. Are you watching? Does it matter? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll be back with Ed Rogers and Anna Greenberg after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tis the season for presidential debates. Last week, the Democrats faced off in South Carolina. Tomorrow, the Republicans take their turn. We're talking with two campaign veterans about how the candidates prepare the stakes in these early debates. And if anybody's paying attention, we'll also bring in Ken Rudin, our political junkie, for his take on the debates and the rest of the week in politics. Right now, our guests are Anna Greenberg, partner with the Democratic consulting firm Greenberg, Quinlan and Rossner. She worked on the presidential campaigns for Bill Clinton in 92 and Al Gore in 2000. And across from her here in the table and Studio 3A is Ed Rogers, Republican strategist and chairman of Barber, Griffith & Rogers. He was a senior deputy in the Bush-Quayle campaign in 1988. And, of course, we want you to join the conversation, too. Do you pay attention to debates 9 months before the primaries begin? Why or why not? What are you looking for? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation. And Ed Rogers, before the break, you were saying that these debates are important and getting more important. How much time do you invest in preparing a candidate? This takes up a lot of time, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly takes up some. I don't know how to exactly quantify it. But again, they are important, and they're particularly important. Usually the first one, less so. But I think tomorrow night's debate is important. The Republican positioning, everybody's position in the Republican field is very fragile. And everybody can do themselves some harm. And the early stages of the race, before the real shooting starts, is really about not losing more than it is about winning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, everybody's position is fragile. Everybody could do themselves some harm. And so the stakes are pretty high.
Yeah. Anna Greenberg, you're presumably making decisions about, well, you know, we could either do these three fundraisers or we can assemble a murder board of people to quiz our candidate to make sure that he or she is up to snuff here.
Campaigns spend a significant time doing campaign debate prep, and it's not just preparation on the various issues because you have some guesses that you'll get asked about Iraq and mm-hmm. other leading issues of the day, healthcare or energy or immigration, but you don't know the whole. So you're going to prepare, you know, on every single issue. But also you have to prepare. It's not just the one-liners. It's how am I going to respond to attacks? So it was completely predictable that John Edwards would get a question about his haircut. And it's completely predictable that Hillary Clinton would get a question about her favorability ratings. And you know that they prepared very carefully their answers to those questions.
Let's get another report. A question on the line from a listener. It might be a reporter. This is Sonny. Sonny with us from Minneapolis.
Hey, how's it going, Gary?
All right.
Listen, I'm 26. I've been following all this since the beginning. I can't wait for these debates to get going. But I'm wondering, how smart is it for the candidates to possibly attack the other side? We've seen a political standoff. I mean, I think in the United States we're just waiting to see this explosion, you know, between these two parties fighting back and forth. How much do you think we're going to see them fighting each other? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Sonny, thanks very much. Anna?
I think you will see Democrats critical of Republicans but not each other, and you will see Republicans critical of Democrats but not each other. It, as Ed said earlier, it is far too early for the candidates to be attacking each other in these debates. Right now, especially for the second-tier candidates, they have to establish who they are, their gravitas, their standing, their breadth of knowledge, their policy expertise. They need to define themselves. I don't think you're going to see internal infighting for a long time.
Mm. Let's go to Adam. Adam is with us from North Java in New York.
Yes, yes.
Go ahead, please.
I was wondering, a while back, Hillary Clinton was asked a rather direct question about her, whether or not she regretted her, you know, the issues in Iraq. And she got criticism for not answering rather directly. And it seems that a lot of these debates are filled with political rhetoric. Can we expect to see some of the candidates maybe becoming a little more bold and beginning to answer questions a little more directly and steer away from the rhetoric that is so common?
Well, Ed Rogers, something like Hillary Clinton's response to why did you vote yes to authorize it, this is a very carefully, not only carefully rehearsed, but carefully repeated line. She does not want to stray from it.
And it's a problem.
Sure.
I was going to say the caller makes a good point, and that's that the viewers have an expectation and are looking for authenticity. So too much, being too rehearsed, being too scripted, being too polished is a negative in this environment. And again, the debates, so-called debates, are multi-candidate appearances. They're not real debates. You don't really have crosstalk and really engagement between the parties. Everything's filtered through a moderator, and it's very scripted. And so they don't really lend themselves to push back and challenge or boring in on a particular candidate or a particular issue, and it won't until the crowd gets smaller and things become more intense as we approach the real voting.
And I guess, Anna, I'd follow up with that by saying, generally it's a plus if your candidate has a sense of humor, but you also have to be very careful.
Well, I think absolutely having a sense of humor is a plus. People want to like the people they vote for, and part of what people like is when people have a sense of humor and they don't take themselves too seriously, but candidates still need to have gravitas and standing, so it's a fine balance. But I want to follow up on what Ed said. In terms of the war in Iraq, at the moment, you are not going to see the Democrats attacking each other on it, and I think you'll see a fair amount of unity in the Republican debate on Iraq, which I actually think is a real interesting challenge for them. But this will be one of the biggest points of differentiation eventually in the Democratic primary field, and you will see later debates, and you will see there was some veiled attempts at it in this particular debate, but you will see them differentiating themselves from each other, not to mention the fact that the situation in Iraq is dynamic and there are things happening in Congress right now, and some of these folks are actually going to have to take votes on these questions. And so I think this will become a differentiating issue, even if at the moment they're not directly engaging each other on it.
And we'll get to some of those questions in a moment. And by the way, we should clarify what you said earlier. You said John Edwards could expect a question about his $400 haircut. That, of course, from the moderator, not from one of the other candidates.
That's right.
Yeah. Here's an email question, and this from Gordon in Ypsilanti. My question for the guests, thank you, by the way, very much, Adam. My question for the guests is if they think that Newt Gingrich's call for presidential candidates to commit to a regular schedule of lengthy debates is likely to be adopted. And I guess that's a question that depends on the campaigns coming up, what they think is good for them. Normally, front runners don't like debates.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually happening. I think there's going to be more debates now than there were 4 years ago, and there'll be more debates or so-called debates 4 years from now than there are today. I mean, I think that's the way we're going. I think we're having more with the proliferation of media, there's more outlets, there's more appetite, there's more space to fill, so to speak, in the media universe, and so you're going to see more occasions for candidates to talk among themselves and to be challenged as a group, not just as individuals, on the occasional interview.
Mm-hmm.
That answers the question.
I guess that answers the question. But here's sort of a follow-up, and this was a point you were making earlier, Ed Rogers. This is a question from Nick in Duluth, Minnesota. Is it even accurate to label these appearances debates? Nearly all the debates I've seen in the recent past have consisted of the candidates just making statements, which are usually disconnected with the previous comments. Why aren't there actual debates instead of these question and answer or statement-making sessions? And I guess that depends on who's staging the debate and how they're staging it.
Well, it has to do with the rules the candidates agree to. It has to do with the media outlets that sponsor it. But I think that I have read that there'll be a debate a month for the rest of this year. That's a lot of debates. Yeah. And I think that if no news comes out of them, in other words, if they are staged and they're rehearsed and we get the same kind of statements, for the next 6 months, I imagine the coverage of these debates will drop off.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll become less interesting and less important as the year goes on.
All right. Let's get this is Chris on the line. Chris is with us from St. Louis.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that it's refreshing to hear from some of the lesser-known candidates, like Senator Gravel, for example, from the former senator from Alaska, when he calls out certain senators or he brings up issues, and he's not so staged and upfront. So it's pretty refreshing as an American to hear some of these issues that are just brought right out there, and like when he called out Barack Obama with his stance on Iran and the
mm-hmm. A candidate like a Mike Gravel, who's not given an awfully good chance of winning the nomination. In a sense, he's got a lot to gain and not an awful lot to lose, Ed Rogers.
Well, I'll defer to Anna on the Democrat side, but here you have a guy that's really playing a role. He's not really running for president. He's no stronger after the debate than he was before. And he sort of offers a clownish or, sort of a, sort of a clownish role. That's, I think, is distracting in a lot of ways and doesn't contribute much.
Mm-hmm.
Anne? One of the things that I noticed about this debate that I thought was actually disturbing was that it replicated what we see in every other aspect of coverage of this race, that the so-called top-tier front-runners actually got more time than the second-tier candidates. In fact, there was an analysis that showed that Hillary Clinton got about 12 minutes, and I believe Biden got about 8, and Chris Dodd about 5, and Richardson about 5. I don't know why they did that, but given that this is probably the only opportunity where you're supposed to get equal time, it is interesting to me that MSNBC chose to give more time to the front-runners in this debate.
Hmm. Thanks very much, Chris.
Oh, thanks.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. You will be amazed to learn that Ken Rudin has been sitting at this table absolutely quiet for 10 minutes.
And awake.
To tell us more about how the Democrats did last week in South Carolina and a look ahead to tomorrow night's Republican debates, Ken Rudin is with us, NPR's political editor and our political junkie. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil.
You were down in South Carolina. What were the highlights for you?
Well, I guess the thing is, Anna made a very good point that from the beginning, you knew that everybody was going to talk about Hillary and Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, how they would interact, whether they would go on the attack, whether they would be defensive, whether they would be scripted. And yet there are a lot of candidates who had a lot to say. Now, Ed Rogers talks about the fact that maybe we didn't need to hear from Mike Gravel because he has no chance to get the nomination. That's true. But at the same time, he brought up some things that many rank-and-file Democrats are talking about the war and what's going on with Iran and whether the Democrats are too cautious. As Dennis Kucinich said, how can you be against the war and still vote to fund the war? So even though these candidates are considered fringe by many in the media, by many of us, yet they have something to say, and we'll probably see that tomorrow in the Republican debate, too, with Tom Tancredo, Ron Paul, for example, the congressman from Texas, a lot of interesting ideas. Are they going to win the nomination? No, but there's some things that they will bring up that other candidates will not bring up.
And certainly spice up the viewing, at least, for somebody who's in the audience.
But it does frustrate a lot of people who want a serious debate among the people who are likely to get the nomination. You had 8 people in South Carolina last week. You'll have 10 tomorrow in California. There's a Fox debate on May 15th in South Carolina, sponsored by Fox News, I should say. And Fox is now talking about winnowing the field of those candidates who can appear at the debate. They're either going to look at some polling numbers or some kind of criteria to limit it to 10, because otherwise it becomes unmanageable. But again, this is the time when you want to hear from all the candidates, perhaps maybe a month or two before Iowa, you want to narrow it down, some kind of criteria. But now I want to hear from everybody what they have to say and what they offer and what they bring to the table.
Ed Rogers, would you get into trouble at this point if you said, look, we can't have all of these candidates? If you as a campaign manager said, no, come on, two or three, you'd be fine, but eight, you're crazy.
Sure. By definition, it's undemocratic to be excluding anybody at this point. So the least worst option is to include everybody.
Mm-hmm. Even though, Anna, that means you're going to get less time. And if you're one of the top tier candidates, you're looking equal to fringe candidates.
I tend to agree with Ed and Ken. I can't imagine how you could exclude people at this stage. We're a year and a half out. This is not the moment to be telling people they can't participate in debates.
We're talking with campaign veterans Anna Greenberg and Ed Rogers. Also with us is NPR's political editor and political junkie Ken Rudin. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go to one of the highlights of the debate in South Carolina. And this is really became the talking point. A moderator, NBC anchor Brian Williams, asked Barack Obama what he would do in the event of a massive terrorist attack on American soil. This was the question.
God forbid, 1,000 times while we were gathered here tonight, we learned that two American cities had been hit simultaneously by terrorists, and we further learned, beyond the shadow of a doubt, it had been the work of Al-Qaeda. How would you change the U.S. military stance overseas as a result?
And Ken Rudin, Barack Obama gave a fairly lengthy and contextualized answer, but his opponents were quick to seize on the fact afterwards that his words, at least initially, did not include retaliate.
It reminds me almost of the Bernie Shaw question asked of Michael Dukakis about if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered. He gave a long, drawn-out answers about theory and what to do, and there was no emotion in it. And I thought everybody talks about how Hillary Clinton has been so scripted and cautious, and I thought the fact that she addressed this question very forcefully, perhaps she was looking at the general election audience as well as the Democratic Party electorate, but I thought she came off very strong saying exactly what she would do. And I think that Barack Obama, who had the reputation of being a rock star, of being the greatest thing ever, seemed to be off his game and a little more hesitant than I expected.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a caller on the line, and this is Anita. Anita with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is this. You were asking, what do you think of the different issues in the early debates really matters the most? And my comment is that, unfortunately, I think none of it really matters to the majority of Americans. I think they're more interested in who's left on American Idol than being able
no
to
question.
Name five of the Democratic candidates that are running in the primaries.
I don't think you're going to get an argument there. There's certainly a lot more votes for American Idol.
Right.
Who really is the audience at this juncture? Ken Rudin, is it journalists like yourself?
Well, it probably is, because the way we report what they say and the way we interpret how they did, these artificial scorecards, people carry that for the rest of the time. It's also the audience is also people in Iowa and New Hampshire, because even if the rest of the American people are not especially paying attention that much, people in Iowa are. People in New Hampshire are. They are professional politician watchers, and they watch very carefully. It's still 8 months and change until the Iowa caucuses, which is not a long time from now. First impressions are very important. So I think these voters are really paying attention to mm-hmm. see what's going to happen.
Anna Greenberg, who else is paying attention?
Well, the structure of these campaigns is right now really what they need to do more than anything is fundraise. I mean, that's still a number one issue. So to the extent that anybody comes out of any of these debates with a surge or with momentum, it's going to be very important for fundraising and bringing in endorsements and allies. So I think building the campaign comes out of these debates. But it's absolutely the case that very few people are paying attention. I would say, though, that the media interpretation of these debates and the collective wisdom about them build over time. And so even if in the moment people who are really just going to vote in the general election aren't paying attention now, mm-hmm. the impressions that get built now have an impact next year.
And would you, Ed Rogers, before your candidate went out for one of these, and thank you very much for the call, Anita, would you say, look, the main thing is it's all right if you get criticized for being too cautious, just don't do anything stupid.
Yeah, do no harm, sure. That's the first rule.
Yeah, don't do a Gerry Ford and free Poland before it's actually
don't
free.
Don't do that. Yeah. Rule one, do no harm. Rule number two, don't be inhibited by the question. You know, say what you need to say.
You say what you need to say. With a very good question. But the thing that I really wanted to say, that's the answer. Ken Rudin, you stay right with us, but we're going to let our campaign veterans go. Anna Greenberg, a Democratic consultant with the firm Greenberg, Quinlan and Rossner. Thanks very much,
as always. Thank you.
Ed Rogers, a Republican strategist and chairman of Barber, Griffith and Rogers, LLC, a consulting firm here in Washington. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you a lot.
They were both here with us in Studio 3A. There's still plenty of political news to talk about, however. We'll get to the Iraq spending bill and the presidential veto and the rest of the week's news when we come back. If you have questions for the political junkie, you can call in now, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.